You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. Music in Stone, Architecture and Sense of Life by Barry Wood.
At the beginning of part four of The Fountainhead, Ayn Rand introduces us to a boy on a bicycle who's riding through the woods of Pennsylvania. And he comes across the latest work of Howard Roark, the protagonist of the novel. And we see it through his eyes and through his mind. And this is what she says, Miss Rand says, quote, "There were many houses. They were small. They were cut off from one another, and no two of them were alike. But they were like variations of a single theme, like a symphony played by an inexhaustible imagination. And one could still hear the laughter of the force that had been let loose on them, as if that force had run, unrestrained, challenging itself to be spent, but had never reached its end. Music, he thought, the promise of the music he had invoked, the sense of it made real. There it was before his eyes. He did not see it. He heard it in chords. He thought that there was a common language of thought, sight, and sound. Was it mathematics? The discipline of reason. Music was mathematics, and architecture was music in stone. He knew he was dizzy because this place below him could not be real." Close quote. This is a very striking passage, a very beautiful passage, and quite a striking metaphor that architecture is music in stone. And this is what I want to explore in my lecture today. Now, the parallels between music and architecture have been observed as far back as the Greeks. The followers of Pythagoras were very enamored of number, particularly of ratios, and those ratios are expressed in Greek architecture. In the first century AD, the Roman architectural theorist Vitruvius said that architects should understand music theory. The medievals were obsessed with numbers, and it comes out in their architecture. Now, the obsession with numbers kind of fades out in the early modern period, 17th century or so. But in the early 19th century, both Schelling and Goethe in Germany refer to architecture as frozen or silent music. So people are obviously observing something here, which I want to pursue in my remarks. This is a building in Florence. This is the Church of Santa Maria Novella by Leon Battista Alberti, and it was completed in 1470. And if you look at the facade of the building, you can start to see how the way we understand architecture does indeed lend itself to a comparison with the way we perceive music. For example, you appreciate this facade by recognizing things like repeated units, such as down here, there are pointed arches at the bottom, basically because the bottom half of the facade had been finished already in the late medieval period. Alberti was asked to finish it by adding something on top. There are repeated round arches up here, which have within them smaller repeating units of these double motifs. Then, of course, the squares across the top, which are reflected in the rectangles, circular motifs in the top section. You recognize things like symmetry when things are alike. So the building is symmetrical from side to side, including the fact that the second arch from going out from the central door is higher. You have symmetrical S brackets and circles on the top section. You recognize things like transitions from one section of architecture or music to another, such as the brackets I just mentioned. This is an extremely clever move on Alberti's part, and it was copied over and over in the later Renaissance, making the transition from this top section to the bottom section very elegant, as opposed to just putting one block on top of another block. And you recognize the way things are related to each other in a kind of key. So the repeated motif of the stripes on the bottom, or of the squares on the top, or of the circles and the filler motifs around them, all these form a kind of relational mode which you could compare to a musical key. Now, Ayn Rand uses a further musical metaphor in The Fountainhead, which I can't resist adding. This is when she's describing the house that Roark built for Gail Wynand. And she says, "It was as if from the wide living room on the first level, a hand had moved slowly, shaping the next steps by a sustained touch, then had stopped, had continued in separate movements, each shorter, brusquer, then had ended, torn off, remaining somewhere in the sky. So that it seemed as if the slow rhythm of the rising fields had been picked up, stressed, accelerated, and then broken into the staccato chords of the finale." Now, I want you to observe. Okay, now it's working with me. There's a crucial similarity and difference between architecture and the decorative arts. So, for example, you can have a very beautiful rug. This is a Persian carpet in the Met. Okay, and the same thing, the same observations I've been making go for something like this. There's symmetry. Okay, there's repeated units. There's symmetry that way. They're repeated units, such as the bud motifs. They're linked by harmonious fillers, like the curving brackets therein, and so on. Okay, you can appreciate something like a vase. This is a Japanese porcelain vase. You can appreciate its form, such as the gentle way that the corners bend down, or the way that the corners are enlivened by the addition of the painted motifs. Okay. You could enjoy a Tiffany lamp with the way that the stained glass has been brought down to be like drooping flowers over the central stem of the lampstand. Now, these are all indeed formally beautiful. All three of these are wonderful pieces. But you should notice the crucial difference from architecture is that these make no appeal to our deepest sense of ourselves vis-a-vis existence, which is the essence of art, with a capital A, or fine art, if you will. Okay? A concretization of our sense of life. Okay? When you see something like the carpet in the middle, you say, nice carpet. Okay? Beautiful carpet. I would love that carpet in my house. But you don't say, wow, this is the world as I see it. This really makes me feel like I'm in the universe as I imagine it. Okay, fair enough. Then what gives architecture this power? What makes for this difference? Well, Ayn Rand writes in the Romantic Manifesto, which is her explicit theory of art, that architecture is, quote, in a class by itself, because it combines art with a utilitarian purpose and does not recreate reality, but creates a structure for man's habitation or use, expressing man's values. Okay, and I want to stress, this is the money point, habitation or use. Architecture, which by its nature is there for you to move around and through as part of pursuing life, as part of pursuing values in life, provides a whole body experience, a transformation of the lived environment that differentiates it from other useful and beautiful arts such as carpets, lamps, vases, fashion. Okay? Architecture appeals to your sense of the universe because in a way it is your universe. This is where you spend your life. We don't sleep in the open. We don't live in trees. We live in buildings. And this is why architecture hits you in your metaphysical value judgments and not merely your appreciation of harmonious form, which is wonderful, but is not the same. Okay. Now, normally I don't like text-heavy slides, but I could not resist this one because this is a quote Ayn Rand wrote in her journals. That architecture is the most important of the arts, changing the face of nature, man's background, that against which his whole life is played. Later in the journal, she also quotes the architect and theorist Le Corbusier, who said, architecture is the first manifestation of man creating his own universe. And this is perfect. This is absolutely eloquent. Also think back to the Fountainhead. Why does Howard Roark want to become an architect? What does he tell, I believe, the dean? Or Henry Cameron, I'm not sure. Quote, because I love this earth, that's all I love. I don't like the shape of things on this earth. I want to change them. Okay, so he wants to remake the world he lives in his own thought and image. So in this talk, I want to examine four of the aspects of architecture that address our metaphysical value judgments and thus our sense of life. I want to ask, what does each of these four say to us about ourselves, our nature as beings, our relation to existence? How, in its appeal to our whole body sense of being, does architecture resonate with our deepest held ideas about ourselves and the universe we live in? And I've taken the liberty of having each of them begin with S so that they're easier to remember. The first one is setting, or where the building is, how it fits into where it is. The second is scale, which is how big is the building compared to you? Okay, so not absolute size, but specifically its scale in relation to a human body. The third one is space, or the interior of the building. What's it like to move through? Because that's what the building is there for. It's not a sculpture. And finally, the surface, or I could have said skin. Okay, and this is the decoration of the building. What does the ornament of the architecture do for us in terms of meeting our sense of life? Okay. There we go. The setting of a building is important because it appeals to our sense of, or the answer we have in our mind to the question, what's my relation to the earth? Okay. What am I as a being doing, living on the earth? Do I fit? Do I not? Okay. Now, a quote from the Fountainhead should make this clear. This is the description of Rourke's design for Austin Heller's house on the cliff. Quote, "The house on the sketches had been designed not by Rourke, but by the cliff on which it stood. It was as if the cliff had grown and completed itself and proclaimed the purpose for which it had been waiting. The house was broken into many levels, following the ledges of the rock, rising as it rose in gradual masses, in planes flowing together up into one consummate harmony. The walls, of the same granite as the rock, continued its vertical lines upward. The wide projecting terraces of concrete, silver as the sea, followed the line of the waves of the straight horizon." And another quote, this is again Monadnock Valley through the eyes of the boy on the bicycle. Quote, "There were small houses on the ledges of the hill before him, flowing down to the bottom. He knew that the ledges had not been touched, that no artifice had altered the unplanned beauty of the graded steps. Yet some power had known how to build on these ledges in such a way that the houses became inevitable, and one could no longer imagine the hills as beautiful without them. As if the centuries and the series of chances that had produced these ledges and the struggle of great blind forces had waited for their final expression, had been only a road to a goal, and the goal was these buildings, part of the hills, shaped by the hills, yet ruling them by giving them meaning." Now, this is the power of setting in architecture. So as a first example of setting, what could you do with, say, a plot of land by a river? This is what you could do. This is the Taj Mahal in Agra, India, which was built between 1632 and 1653, in case anybody's taking notes. Now, the conventional wisdom about the Taj Mahal is that it's a love monument, that the Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan was heartbroken when his wife Mumtaz Mahal died, and therefore built the world's most beautiful building for her as a tomb. And for once in art history, this is actually true. It's completely verifiable. And we've actually gone so far as to understand the symbolism. The Taj is meant to be a replica of the pavilion in paradise that Mumtaz Mahal is enjoying, because she's died and gone to heaven. And in heaven, in Islamic belief, you inhabit pavilions among gardens and running waters. So the entire landscape has been transformed into a garden with this spectacular pavilion atop it. And behind the Taj is the river Yamuna, which is incorporated into the symbolism, and it becomes one of the running rivers of paradise. There's a myth that there was going to be a black Taj Mahal on the other side of the river. That's not true, but there was going to be a further continuation of the park. You can actually find on the internet a satellite photo of the site. So the landscape has been transformed in the image of this paradise symbolism. Okay, what could you do with, say, a waterfall in the woods of Western Pennsylvania? You could do this. Okay, this is Falling Water by Frank Lloyd Wright, built between 1936 and 1939. And as with so many things by Frank Lloyd Wright, this is a very virtually perfect integration of architecture with landscape. I'm sure you know the story that the patron told Frank Lloyd Wright that he wanted to build a house on the spot where, as a boy, he used to play by a certain waterfall. Now, any other architect would have just popped the house near or next to the waterfall. Wright built the house on the waterfall. The waterfall actually passes under, I think, the fireplace. So this is an example of a house that grows out of its environment. It merges. Even the colors of the materials that Wright used are deliberately there to merge with the forest and to become part of the forest. In fact, Wright once said in a couple of lectures that he gave, quote, "The good building makes the landscape more beautiful than it was before the building was built." Now, for another approach to a similar request, I could show you this building. This is by the modernist architect Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. It's in Plano, Illinois, and it's called the Farnsworth House, because Farnsworth was the name of the woman who requested it. Now, notice it's basically a steel and glass box atop a platform, which you reach by a short stairway. This is a forest in Illinois. You get the sense that it could have been a cornfield in Nebraska, or a glacier in Alaska, or the bottom of the Grand Canyon. Mies would have built the same antiseptic glass box. There is virtually no effort to integrate with the forest. He simply places it in the forest. And among the trees and the grass and the chirping birds, you're going to sit on these tubular steel chairs and look through your giant rectangular glass pane. And there is this complete obliviousness to the world around him. Mies is very unworldly in this sense. Good. The next aspect, or S word, that I want to consider is scale, which, as I said, is the size of the building considered in relation to you. And the question that this addresses in our minds or our metaphysical value judgments is, am I meaningful or am I insignificant? Okay. Am I a man or am I a termite in the face of the universe? So this is an example of scale which takes man into account in a positive way. This is the Erechtheion in Athens. It's on the same hill as the Parthenon, and it was built around the same time, between, we think, 421 and 406 BC. And I was very happy to find a photograph with an actual person, because this gives you a very good sense that this is a large building, as it's supposed to be. It's sacred to two gods, okay, Athena and Poseidon. So there is no question that this is a very important building, you know, to be respected and revered and so on. But it is built to a human scale. When you stand in front of it, you can see the top without having to crane your neck way back. I don't know the numbers, but it is undoubtedly modular in the sense that it is, you know, sort of the golden mean times the human height or something high, so that even your implicit sense of space makes it feel comfortable and right, and you fit here, and this building is for you. It is a man-scaled temple for a man-centered culture. Now, need I say it, not all cultures and not all religions feel this way about man. So this is the Basilica of St. Peter in Rome, built between 1506 and 1626. And if you squint, look very carefully, these are human beings. Okay, these are men and women like you and me. And they are absolutely lost in the cavernous space of St. Peter's. What's the motivation behind this? I quote from somebody who should know, Ellsworth Tuohy. This is his testimony at the Stoddard Temple lawsuit trial. He says, quote, "I have endeavored to show that the two essentials of the conception of a temple are a sense of awe and a sense of man's humility. We have noted the gigantic proportions of religious edifices, the soaring lines, the horrible grotesques of monster-like gods or later gargoyles. All of it tends to impress upon man his essential insignificance, to crush him by sheer magnitude, to imbue him with that sacred terror which leads to the meekness of virtue." Now, in St. Peter's, as with so much Renaissance art, there's a bit of a contradiction, because the sculptures of the saints and holy figures are really athletic, beautiful human beings. So there's the contradiction in Renaissance art, but the intention of the size of the building is quite clear. I mean, this inscription up top, the letters are 4.5 feet high. Okay, just the inscription is almost as big as a human being. So you are meant to be squashed into a sense of nothingness that leads to the meekness of virtue. This is not limited to the West nor to religion. Okay. These are the ruins of a palace in Uzbekistan, in a small town called Shahrisabz. Shahrisabz was the birthplace of the Central Asian conqueror Timur, who's known in the West as Tamerlane. who in the late 1300s, right around 1400, waged a campaign of conquest throughout Central Asia. His idea of marketing his skills was to build towers of human skulls outside cities that he had conquered. And he liked things big, because these at the bottom are people. This was the front door of the palace. In fact, if you look carefully right there and there, you can just make out that this is the beginning of an arch. An arch was springing. And if you kind of project in your mind how high the arch was going to be, right, that's quite the front door. And to add to it, there's Arabic inscriptions on the side which say, the Sultan is the shadow of God. He, of course, considering himself the Sultan. So this is very much meant to make you feel tiny in the face of the force of nature that Timur fancied himself to be. In the background is a sculpture that the grateful Uzbek government made of Timur to celebrate the local boy made good or evil, as the case may be. We know Timur was a megalomaniac about size. There's an anecdote that he conquered some city or other, and a local calligrapher wanted to ingratiate himself with the new big boss. So to show his skill, he wrote a Quran that was so tiny you could fit it under a signet ring. And Timur said, basically, take your trinket and beat it. So the calligrapher probably stomped home and fumed for a while, and then he wrote a Quran that was so big it required camels to carry the thing to Timur. Now Timur was impressed, and he showered him with golden favors and whatnot. Okay. And this isn't limited to the Middle Ages either. This is the Ministry of Agriculture in Warsaw, which was built for the communist government in the mid-1950s. And unfortunately, there's no people in the picture, but you really get a sense of the scale. It is absolutely colossal. This completely pointless colonnade is there to make you feel like a termite. And interestingly and predictably, all totalitarian architecture is this way. If you slapped the swastika on this, it could have come from Nazi Germany. In fact, I was hard-pressed which totalitarian regime to take an example from. Okay. Now, the next aspect of architecture I want to consider is space, which is, what is it like to move through this building? Because, to repeat, that's what buildings are for. I have to note, space is extremely difficult to talk about using photographs. You have to be there, because your perception of space is a complex mixture of motion, depth perception, acoustics, and even air pressure. So showing you a photograph is barely an entree. We really should have ARI give us money for like an architectural tour or something. Space creates an atmosphere. And I want to quote again from Ellsworth Tuohy, who is not talking about space per se, but he is talking about the atmosphere created inside a building. And again, he's slamming the Stoddard Temple. He says, quote, "Instead of the soaring lines reaching for heaven, demanded by the very nature of a temple, as a symbol of man's quest for something higher than his little ego, this building, the Stoddard Temple, is flauntingly horizontal, its belly in the mud, thus declaring its allegiance to the carnal, glorifying the gross pleasures of the flesh above those of the spirit. A person entering a temple seeks release from himself. He wishes to humble his pride, to confess his unworthiness, to beg forgiveness. He finds fulfillment in a sense of abject humility. Man's proper posture in a house of God is on his knees." Unquote. Well, here's a building to we might approve of. This is a church in France in a town called Conques. It's the Abbey Church of Sainte-Foy. It was built in the 11th century. Now, in this period, architecture in the West is recovering from the Dark Ages, when very little of size or importance was built. But the technology is such that the only way they know how to make a building high is to just keep piling up stones. And the higher a building gets, the heavier it gets. Okay, so you can't punch windows in it. You can't have too much open space, or the building will fall down. Okay, so they did their best to make this building quite high, but the price you pay is very thick piers, very small windows. The amount of light, this photo is a bit of a cheat because the apse was completed later and it allows in more light. But this building is very heavy, very thick around you. If you look up, the only way they knew how to close an arch was the old Roman arch. That's why this style is called Romanesque, because they're using old ancient Roman techniques. So you get these long barrel vaults, and looking up is like looking at a wall. Okay, so this is space that daunts and oppresses you. Now, a couple hundred years later, architecture and architectural technology have progressed. This is Rheims Cathedral, built in the 13th century. And I mean all of the 13th century. It took 100 years. Now, technology has improved to the point where they know how to make the building lighter. Okay? They can use buttresses to take the weight of the roof off the walls. This means the walls can have more windows. The walls can have more openings. There's more light. Light can flood the place. Moreover, they have started to use pointed arches, which give a much different feeling when you look up, because it's no longer like looking at a blank wall. Your eye is given directionals to follow. Okay, there's all these little colonnettes which lead up to the ceiling, called sort of pointed vaults, Gothic vaults, and there's a point. I mean, literally, it comes to a point, and that's why people say that, and I think accurately, that the space of a Gothic cathedral soars. Okay, there's a sense of elevation taking you with it. It's very spiritual in that there's a sense of rising to heaven, anti-earthly, yes, but a much more positive sense of communion with the divine than simply crushing you with a big high space. Now, here's a different religious tradition. This is the interior of a Hindu temple in northern India at a site called Khajuraho, and it is roughly contemporary with the two slides ago, the Romanesque building I showed you from Konk. This is the sacred space. Okay, this is, in fact, the most sacred space. Only a Brahmin, so a priest of the highest caste, is allowed to go in. Over here, there's a blurry little figure which gives you some sense of the human space. And as you can tell, the ceiling is low and very heavy. In fact, outside, there's a very tall stone, solid stone tower. So everything is dark, oppressive, sinking in on you. And this is very appropriate for a religious tradition, which revels in the sense of pushing away sense perception. Okay? Because what do holy men in Hinduism do? They go off into the forest and they meditate. You close your eyes, you listen to your breathing, you push away sight, sound, all the sense perception of the Maya, right? The deceptive material world, to get a sense of escaping sense perception into an interior truth. And that dark interiority is very eloquently brought out in this kind of space. And coming to the modern period, this isn't a religious building, it's a house. This is one of the houses built for the faculty of the Bauhaus in Germany. So you may know that the Bauhaus was kind of the epicenter of modern art and architecture in the early 20th century. This is one of the houses that Walter Gropius built for the faculty. They're called the master's houses. Okay. Now, this is a wonderful example of a really awkward space, a really painful space. You feel like you're going to get poked in the head by this sharp corner. Okay. The ceiling is flat, low. Everything is this white concrete. You can find pictures on the internet and give yourself a virtual walkthrough. It is intensely awkward and uncomfortable, but it suits the sort of new rules of modern beauty. And so it was great for Gropius and his crowd. So this is give you some sense of interiority. And finally, the last aspect of architecture I want to consider here is surface. Meaning the ornament of the building. And surface is where the whole music in stone metaphor becomes really interesting. Because I think that Ayn Rand's theory of music can, the necessary changes being made, mutatis mutandis, shed a lot of light on our appreciation of ornament, whether in the decorative arts or architecture. Think about what Ayn Rand said about music, and I quote from the Romantic Manifesto, quote, "A man's acceptance or rejection of a piece of music depends on whether it calls upon or clashes with, confirms or contradicts his mind's way of working. which a couple pages earlier she had referred to as the level of cognitive functioning on which he feels at home, his psychoepistemological sense of life. The metaphysical aspect of the experience is the sense of a world which he is able to grasp, to which his mind's working is appropriate. And this is why I say that the surface of a building is addressing your metaphysical question or value judgment of, does my mind fit the world? In perceiving and visually exploring the ornament of a building, you experience pleasure or annoyance, or discomfort or joy, in the engagement of your mind at a certain level of functioning. Now, I'm differentiating from a couple things here. I'm not talking about sculpture, which is very often used in architectural decoration. Sculpture is a fine art, it has its own rules. I'm specifically talking about non-figural decoration. And I also want to differentiate from the decorative arts, as I suggested before, because the decorative arts adorn objects in your world. Architectural ornament adorns your world, as the architect has built it for you. Okay. Now, this is from a building in Isfahan, Iran, which is known as the Mosque of Sheikh Lutfullah. We think it was a private prayer chamber for the Iranian monarch, and it's a detail of the area in which the circle of the dome is being transitioned into the square of the room down below. And it was completed in 1619, for those who are taking notes. Now, this is an absolutely astonishing achievement of decorative art. Because if you sort of send yourself into it to analyze how it works, everything fits so beautifully, perfectly, and crisply. So you can go from floor to ceiling or ceiling to floor. You can't see the floor, so I'll start with the ceiling. There's this amazing sunburst of arabesques at the top, at the pinnacle of the dome, at the edges of which it meshes with a series of a shape called an ogive, which is basically an oval, and you pull out two ends a little bit to make points. So these ogives fit into the points of the sunburst. Then the ogives expand outward, getting larger and larger until they meet the edge of the dome, where they're cut in half, and then each edge of the ogives meets the point of an arch, either a window or a blank niche below. Each window or niche is above either the center of a triangle or the peak of a kite-shaped ornament. Now, all of these are carrying the stresses of the dome down into the ground. So all of the shapes here, the form of the building, is actually structural. But it's been covered with this absolutely remarkable mosaic technique. And how they planned this on a curved surface in the year 1619, right, before CAD-CAM or whatever people use now, simply blows my mind. And even if you look inside the kites, okay, or elsewhere, you notice that the ornament has been carefully designed to fit exactly that shape. It's never cut off at the edge. Okay? Like these curls all meet the edge, but have been calculated to turn corners at just the right place. Okay, I mean, I visited this building in 2004, and I must have spent 3 or 4 hours. In total. I just went back and back, because it's like being inside a mathematical equation. Now, you have to be careful about drawing conclusions about what this means for the sense of life of the builders. I mean, this is 17th century Iran. We're not talking the Enlightenment. Okay, so just like with music, you can't say that sort of fast, perky music means a benevolent sense of life, and lugubrious, slow music means a tragic sense of life. So with this, I don't want to draw any conclusions about the people, but it's the beginning of something. Now, this is very different from a different kind of architectural decoration, such as this. This is a church in the Bavarian countryside called the Wieskirche, or the Pilgrimage Church of Wies, built in 1745 to 54. So this actually is the Enlightenment. Now, anybody know what this style is called? Rococo, yes. Now, very, very different from the geometric precision, the crispness of what I was just showing you, because Rococo revels in kind of frivolity, okay? Curved lines that end up going nowhere. pastel colors that are totally harmless, simpering putti. It's very, very large. And what does it give your consciousness? It gives it something to play with, which is basically cotton candy. This is how I think of Rococo. And it was the dominant architectural style of much of the Enlightenment, but there are a number of people who think that it's really nauseating. Now, finally, if I take you into the modern era, this is a movie theater in Berlin, built in 1928 to 29. It's called Babylon, Kino Babylon. And this is what you get when you take ornament out of the picture entirely. Okay. It's a very large building. It's a building devoted to an art. In fact, an art which was flourishing in Weimar Germany. I mean, some of the great early movies were made in Germany. So you'd think that a temple to this art would have some concession to visual beauty, but there is none. Okay? It is entirely mute. In fact, it's so large and so blank, personally, it gives me a sense of suffocating muteness, like in a nightmare when you can't scream and you get that pushing feeling that there should be something there, but there's not. And that is the intended effect. Ornament was considered a crime. Literally, there is a book called Ornament and Crime, which was a theoretical text, very influential at the turn of the 20th century. Okay. Now, on the subject of ornament, Ayn Rand wrote in a letter to a person named Gerald Loeb. She wrote, quote, "You are right that plain shoebox modernism is cold, boring, and has no human appeal whatever. The solution, however, is in an architecture such as Frank Lloyd Wright's. That is, buildings which are not plain and bare, but with a complicated, ingenious pattern and an ornament of their own. But an ornament designed for that particular structure, strictly original and not borrowed from any established historical style." So this is what architectural ornament should be. It is very rare to find it in that form. But you do find it in Frank Lloyd Wright, and that's who I'll turn to next. Because the architectural ideal, just like in any art, is to have complete unity of effect, where everything points to the effect you want, the theme you've provided, and nothing contradicts it or hangs in excess. Howard Rourke speaks to the dean about his architectural ideals, and he says, quote, "Nothing can be reasonable or beautiful unless it's made by one central idea, and the idea sets every detail. A building is alive like a man. Its integrity is to follow its own truth, its one single theme, and to serve its own single purpose. A man doesn't borrow pieces of his body. A building doesn't borrow hunks of its soul. Its maker gives it the soul, and every wall, window, and stairway to express it." And a very small number of architects have ever done this. Frank Lloyd Wright is one. And I actually had to work hard not to make this a Frank Lloyd Wright lecture. But now I've come to the example I want to use. That's a building called Unity Temple, which was built by Wright in 1905 to 1908 in Oak Park, Illinois. It's a religious building, but the religion is a kind of very watered down, you know, Unitarian kind of Christianity. So it's not a Catholic church. He did synagogues and Orthodox churches and whatnot, but this building was as secular as you could get in a religion. Now, when you look at the exterior of the building, there's two sections. This photograph doesn't show both sections, but they're very distinctly clear. And connected. They both have this essential look. I want you to notice that this building consists entirely of horizontals and verticals, dramatic horizontals and verticals. There are virtually no curves, no corners turned in the non-90-degree sense. Everything is either soaring upward or flying in parallel to the earth. It's true on the outside and the inside. Now, this makes the exterior structure very impressive and dramatic. Okay. And you can talk about sort of symmetry and harmony, like the way that you know, form one level without actually being connected. Black and white is really great for bringing out the kind of strong contrast that Wright has brought out with this use of horizontals and verticals. Okay, he has even, for purely decorative effect, strictly to stress this theme of dramatic horizontals and verticals, indented a little bit in the top sections of some of the roofs. Okay. There is a use of ornament, but the ornament is completely original. It's not a knockoff of Greek or Mayan or Moorish or whatever. It is entirely Frank Lloyd Wright. And it, too, stresses a vertical stem and horizontal, I mean, leaves, if you want to look at it as an organic motif. The interior continues the theme. There's a person, so you can get a sense of the human scale. And again, everything is either a horizontal shooting forward toward the speaker. This is the pulpit. You can kind of see the microphone right there. Or shooting heavenward behind the speaker. And again, there are virtually no curves in here, which means that when there are, they really pop. Okay, so the globes of the lamps. And there's this, I don't know if Wright put this here, I tend to think he did, but there's this circular sort of objet d'art in front of the pulpit. And you can imagine that when a human being stood behind the microphone to give the sermon, as the sole organic, you know, material in this extremely geometric environment, he would really have stood out. And I think that's the point that really makes the preacher pop. And the ornament inside is extremely creative as well. So there's long horizontals and dramatic verticals, and when they meet, there's a party. Okay? So this, Wright was, since his very young years, was incredibly creative with the most basic of forms. Okay? And you can see that, you know, this kind of zigs and zags, these three come up, they form this compartment, and everything is very carefully aligned. For example, this little knob is exactly halfway. It's cut at the halfway point by this horizontal. This turns a corner and then continues its journey onward. It's incredibly original and creative, and it matches the theme of the building. Okay, Unity Temple has this amazing unity of the essential similarity of the structure and the ornament. Okay, it is integrated into a consistent whole, which is amazingly rare in architecture. Now, I often like to think that if, you know, aliens from an advanced civilization had visited planet Earth in about 1910 and gone to Unity Temple, they would have said, okay, the species is doing pretty well. All right, they don't need our help, and then, you know, back to Jupiter or whatever. Unfortunately, mankind did not turn the corner that Wright had suggested. Rather, we come to a period of disintegration in architecture. Okay, when it all comes apart. I want to quote again from Ellsworth. It's not a quote from Ellsworth Tuohy. It's Ayn Rand's description leading up to the part where Ellsworth Tuohy comes out in support of modern architecture. And she writes, quote, "In the countries of Europe, most prominently in Germany, a new school of building had been growing for a long time. It consisted of putting up four walls and a flat top over them, with a few openings. This was called new architecture. The freedom from arbitrary rules for which Cameron had fought, the freedom that imposed a great new responsibility on the creative builder, became mere elimination of all effort, even the effort of mastering historical styles. It became a rigid set of new rules, the discipline of conscious incompetence, creative poverty made into a system, mediocrity boastfully confessed. A building creates its own beauty, and its ornament is derived from the rules of its theme and its structure," Cameron had said. "A building needs no beauty, no ornament, and no theme," said the new architects. This is precisely what happened in Europe. Okay, these are five houses from an exhibition held in Stuttgart in 1927, which are still there as a kind of park. Ayn Rand wrote in her journal that this exhibition was, quote, "nothing but a collection of trashy shoebox houses, none of which means anything, consequently all of which can be considered to produce an effective unity, the unity of nothingness." And the great irony is that these architects knew Frank Lloyd Wright, because a portfolio of about 100 drawings of his plans and elevations had been circulating in Europe and was very popular, but all they took from it was, oh, flat roof. Okay. So this becomes known as the international style. Even though it's centered in Germany, it becomes known as the international style, the motto of which is less is more. And you got, especially in skyscrapers, this is very popular. And you get decade after decade of you can have your building any way you want as long as it's a rectangle. No ornament, nothing but the rigid austerity of steel and glass. I mean, the MetLife building, formerly the Pan Am building, has chamfered corners, and that's about as dramatic as, meaning these have been cut off, it's about as dramatic as they're going to get. So ornament, beauty, creativity have been disintegrated, taken out of architecture. Now, in the 60s, people started to get tired of this. And an architect named Robert Venturi wrote a book called Complexity and Contradiction in Architecture. Note the word contradiction, okay? In which he said, you know, this is boring, this is awful, architecture should be more. And he changed the motto from less is more, meaning let's not have any ornament or anything, to less is a bore. Let's have fun. This is the first postmodern house built by Robert Venturi. And notice his playfulness and contradiction. For example, it has a gabled roof, but he has completely obviated the purpose of a gable, which is to let water run off, right, by taking out the center. Right? It's not even a wall. It's a facade. It's about that thick. If you walk around either side of the house, you'll see that it simply stops. Okay. These sides are asymmetrical, which might be fine, but he starts an arch at the corner of this window, which goes across the house and ends in nothing. It hangs in midair. So this is architecture that smirks at you. Okay? And Robert Venturi built this house for his mother. Right? This is the first postmodern skyscraper in Manhattan. One thing that's, I mean, a positive change is it's not only steel and glass anymore, it's stone. But the architect, Philip Johnson, put this strange peak on top of it, which makes it known as the Chippendale building, because it looks like a furniture cabinet. This is a postmodern building in London. So the positive thing is that the architect wants to involve color, but he makes it all stripy. There's a submarine periscope built into the building for some reason. This is the same architect, James Stirling, who built the building that I endured graduate school in. And I remember the first day I was there, I said, excuse me, how do I get to the Sackler Museum? And the woman goes, well, you walk across Harvard Yard, and you turn left, and it's the building that looks like a ham sandwich. It's very easy to find. Okay. Now, finally, this is a postmodern interior. And I want you to guess, if you know, hush, but if I want you to guess what kind of institution this is. Okay, so notice the really strong primary colors, blue and red, the nice soft wood, okay, the mesh guards here, the nice graspable railings and these soft knobs on top. What would you say it is? A school, like a kindergarten, right, for little kids. This is the business school of Cambridge University in the UK. Like I say, this is architecture that's laughing at you. It's kind of smirking at the idea of serious values. Now, consider what has replaced it. This petered out in about the late 90s. Okay, if you build in this style now, it's deliberately retro. What has replaced it is known as deconstructivism, which the name suggests owes a lot to deconstruction in philosophy. And in fact, one deconstructivist architect actually solicited Derrida's advice when he was building a certain park in Paris. You get buildings like this. This is the Seattle Central Library by Rem Koolhaas, built in 2002-2004. Deconstructivism revels in fragmentation, asymmetry, disharmony. It's the deliberate dismantling of your world. It's seeking to become what architecture is not. What is this? Why would you have a building suspended by this little corner here? Okay, why turn these corners? At any point, the architect is deliberately colliding with your expectations of what should be there, rationally speaking. Okay, inside this building, you know, this is really conducive to study. You know, I want to go to a library and feel like I'm in some kind of prison or you know, bug trap. There's one hallway on the fourth floor where everything, ceiling, floors, wall, everything, doors, is blood red. I mean, a really intense red. The worst color you can surround yourself with. Right. This is by a different architect. This is Daniel Libeskind. This is the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. Okay, so this is what's left of the original building. And this is known as the Michael Leachin crystal, because Michael Leachin is the guy who paid for this. Libeskind's trademark is sharp angles and structures that seem to pierce or engulf older structures. I mean, he's also got a military history museum in Dresden, which is very much like this. I say trademark, it's because he's a one-note hack. We are saved from him. He was actually granted the contract to do the replacement for the World Trade Center in Manhattan. But over time, he was either kicked out or withdrew, and the only idea of his that they kept was that the building should be 1,776 feet tall. So his one good idea was kept. This is the interior of this building. This is a display space. Okay? And as a former museum person, I have to say to the owners, this man is messing with you. Okay? This is meant to flout every rational idea of how to display objects in a museum. But he got in his arbitrary angles, so he's happy. Lastly, this is, anybody know who this architect is? Frank Gehry, yes. I have the privilege of informing you that this building is the Lou Ruvo Center for Brain Health in Las Vegas. Which I'm sure they do wonderful research on Alzheimer's and all sorts of things, but one commentator I like who is very vocal and profane about modern developments in architecture says that calling this thing the Center for Brain Health, he says, quote, the implicit sadism is impressive. Okay. This is the interior. Okay. More about Frank Gehry later if you're so inclined. So in sense of life terms, postmodern architecture is sticking its tongue out at you. Okay, these buildings are giving you the finger. Right? Postmodernism giggles at the very idea of serious values. Deconstructivism lunges at the throat of rationality. But enough of this. All right? To recover a sense of our own universe, let's remember Hopton Stoddard's commission to Howard Roark. Quote, we want to capture in stone, as others capture in music, not some narrow creed, but the essence of all religion. And what is the essence of religion? The great aspiration of the human spirit toward the highest, the noblest, the best. The human spirit as the creator and the conqueror of the ideal. The great life-giving force of the universe. The heroic human spirit. That is your assignment, Mr. Roark. So what does Roark give him and us? I'm going to read the description of the Stoddard Temple, and I want you to listen for the four sense of life aspects that I've been highlighting. So, quote, the temple was to be a small building of gray limestone. Its lines were horizontal, not the lines reaching to heaven, but the lines of the earth. It seemed to spread over the ground like arms outstretched at shoulder height, palms down, in great silent acceptance. It did not cling to the soil, and it did not crouch under the sky. It seemed to lift the earth, and its few vertical shafts pulled the sky down. It was scaled to human height in such a manner that it did not dwarf man, but stood as a setting that made his figure the only absolute, the gauge of perfection by which all dimensions were to be judged. When a man entered this temple, he would feel space molded around him, as if it had waited for his entrance to be completed. It was a joyous place with the joy of exaltation that must be quiet. It was a place where one would come to feel sinless and strong, to find the peace of spirit never granted save by one's own glory. There was no ornamentation inside except the grated projections of the walls and the vast windows. The place was not sealed under vaults, but thrown open to the earth around it, to the trees, the river, the sun, and to the skyline of the city in the distance. The skyscrapers, the shapes of man's achievement on earth. So in the Fountainhead, Ayn Rand provided us with a peerless concretization of an absolutely exalted sense of life, including, as we have just seen, through her descriptions of architecture. Her explicit philosophy of art, as laid out in the Romantic Manifesto, too, provides the tools with which we can begin to understand just how buildings, qua art, speak to us of the worlds we and others imagine. I hope that in exploring these ideas, I've enabled you to hear just a little better the music in the stone. Thank you very much. We have a little bit of time for questions. I ran over a little bit. Sorry about that. Please.
I have a question about setting and style.
Yes.
In the context of Manhattan.
Okay.
So around 1812, the city laid out this rectangular grid system, and also in building the city, streets flattened most of the hills. So there's only gradual rises and falls. So the question is, the context of the city is entirely man-made. It's not trees or rivers or bays. And how would you therefore apply the concept of context to that, where it's an entirely man-made world?
Sure.
And second, size, because of the dense population and business needs, is there's virtually all buildings are very tall. Mm-hmm. In fact, now it's become quite common for even residential buildings to be over 1,000 feet tall.
Wow.
There's a number of them that have been built over 1,000 feet tall. So how could you comment on both setting and size given that limited man-made world?
Sure. Well, that's a very good point, and you used exactly the right word, which is the context, okay? You know, an empty forest or the shore of a river is very different from a place where you are already surrounded by buildings of a certain style. Now, this is a challenge. In one sense, you can use the size of the lot, perhaps, to set things back and have grass or trees or whatever. This is a challenge for Frank Lloyd Wright. I mean, he only ever built one skyscraper. He designed a couple. Most of his buildings go like that, but he built a couple. And he built one which he deliberately wanted to stand out from the rest. So I think it's... you are bouncing off the style of what's around you, whether it's trees or other buildings. The building, the skyscraper, by the way, is, I can't remember the name, but it's in, I think, Bartlesville, Oklahoma. And it's very striking. I mean, typically right. It does not just look like a vertical rectangle. It's very variegated and beautiful. But that's a good point. Thank you.
On the topic of scale, what is it about a skyscraper that doesn't make you feel insignificant, where some of the other buildings you showed that are still very large have the opposite effect? And skyscrapers are significantly larger than those buildings.
Oh, this is true. Okay, skyscrapers and scale. It has a lot to do with the lower floors of the skyscraper, because a skyscraper inherently shoots upward. Now, what you do with this is up to you, but the part that a person encountering the building is going to deal with most is kind of the entrance facade. And so some skyscrapers, the old World Trade Center had a very harsh, and the new World Trade Center actually, one World Trade Center, oh, it's gone, has a very fortress-like, kind of forbidding exterior, whereas others, especially in the old days, would have, you know, Art Deco decoration, and it's very welcoming. And the fact that the rest of the building shoots toward the sky builds on that. So it's either a triumphant rise or it's yet more of a building which wants to step on you. Okay? If you think of the Daily News building in New York, which you can look up on the internet. I think Ayn Rand called it the ugliest building in New York, or one of them. It has this strange relief sculpture, which I think inspired the bizarre relief sculpture that they put on Cortlandt Holmes when they maul Howard Roark's design, with all these strange figures. And then the rest of the building is just a big mute block, as opposed to, you know, shining steel and glass rising skyward. So scale is only part of it, but the scale of what you immediately deal with at the entrance, I think, has a lot to do with your reaction.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, we're out of time, so thank you very much. Have a good day.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.